When I was a little boy, Rabbi Soloveitchik stroked my cheek. 6 decades later, I still feel the force of his touch and the warmth of his caress.
This has been an incredible journey. We've learned about the purview of what Rabbi Soloveitchik thought was appropriate for men and women to study. We've thought together about prayer and repentance. We've learned about Jewish-Christian relations, the way he thought about the State of Israel. We've tried to think together about different communities that man is a part of to find fulfillment. In this last lecture, how are we going to end this series on the thought, the life, the legacy of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik?
It's extremely daunting recognizing that we're at the last lecture. There seems to be so much more that needs to be said, that should be said, that would be appropriate to say, and now we're down to the last lecture. The rabbis tell us that when Moses finished writing the Torah, there was still ink left in his quill. One is never finished. And I wish there were another 8 to be able to do justice to this remarkable personality. And so I enter into this last lecture with a great deal of trepidation, hoping that, in fact, I did do somewhat justice to the enormity and the complexity of this extraordinary personality. What I would like to do in the last lecture is to focus on Rabbi Soloveitchik as a public figure taking public positions, and to choose 2 examples where he actually lands on what one would imagine to be opposite sides of the conversation. When it comes to the opportunity for women to study Torah, which is a complicated issue in the community, a contested issue in the community, he landed on what we would call the more liberal side. The other issue is about entering into and praying in a synagogue that does not have a divider, a mechitza in Hebrew, between men and women. He landed on the more traditional or small c conservative side. Once again, indicating the complexity of his thinking, but showing how he did take stands. One could not necessarily know in advance, particularly where he would land on a specific issue. And the second thing, and I think the final point that I want to make, is to go back to the humanity of this extraordinary intellectual, brilliant figure, and to make the point that geniuses are also people. And we can't overlook that. And I think that when we encounter any human being that we will encounter and have already encountered in the course of our lives, to recognize that to the extent to which we're influenced by them or want to be connected to them, that they themselves are multifaceted. And here I want to specifically focus on Rabbi Soloveitchik's propensity for self-revelation, which is remarkable and unusual, very personal, and also his acknowledgement squarely, openly and honestly of those parts of his life and legacy where he considers himself to have fallen short of the mark. What an amazing capacity for a human being to be able to be so self-aware and to be able to share that self-awareness with others. And to end with him not only as a brain, but also as a heart, as a human being.
We begin our final session together on the thought and life of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. I am grateful, first grateful to the Tikva Fund for giving me this opportunity to immerse myself once again in the life and thought of a great master who continues to have an enormous influence on my own life, and whose teachings I believe are extremely important for the contemporary world. I am sad because our journey is coming to an end. And I am nervous because I know I have not done him the full justice that he deserves. We have discussed Torah only and Torah and. We've discussed prayer and repentance, the individual and the community, Zionism and Jewish-Christian dialogue. We have seen how Rabbi Soloveitchik's life was a mixture of Torah and general knowledge, the contemplative and the active, a focus on Judaism and a focus on the general human condition. In my last presentation, I examined his position on setting guidelines for Jewish-Christian interfaith dialogue. And I want to begin this, our final presentation, by presenting two more examples of public positions that he took, and both of them specifically focused to issues within the Jewish community. First, Torah study for women. Jewish tradition from the days of the Mishnah, the very earliest code of Jewish law, compiled somewhere around the end of the second century, placed significant limitations on the type of Torah study permitted to women. For some, no Torah study was permitted at all. For some, only the Bible, but not the Talmud, only the written law, not the oral law. For some, only oral study, not textual study, a range of positions. There was some significant changes that began to occur in the first part of the 20th century, but basically strict limitations were still in place throughout the Orthodox community. On this issue, Rabbi Soloveitchik took a very strong stand, once again breaking most decisively with the traditionalist Torah-only community. Source number one. In a letter that he wrote in 1953 to Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who was head of the Bureau of Jewish Education in New York City, it's an organization that was devoted to setting policy for many, many, many schools in the New York area, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote the following, 1953. Please accept my apologies for not answering your letter sooner. I was very busy. As to your question with regard to a curriculum in a co-educational school, so the assumption here is that the school is co-ed, both boys and girls, young men and young women are studying together in the same school, in the same classroom, at the same time. I expressed my opinion to you long ago that it would be a very regrettable oversight on our part if we were to arrange separate Hebrew courses for girls. Okay, maybe when they study math or science or history, maybe they could be together, but there were those who felt that these kinds of subjects is okay, but when we study Torah, we have to separate the sexes. Rabbi Soloveitchik said this would be a very regrettable oversight. Not only is the teaching of the oral tradition to girls permissible, but it is nowadays an absolute imperative. This policy of, the next word is very powerful, discrimination. Discrimination in the 50s is a very powerful word, it still is. He doesn't say this policy of differentiating. He says this policy of discriminating between the sexes as to the subject matter and method of instruction, which is still advocated by certain groups within our Orthodox community and continues to be advocated by certain groups within the Orthodox community. And now he says something that's quite extreme, has contributed greatly to the deterioration and downfall of traditional Judaism. To have boys and girls separate, contributes, and not just contributes, but has contributed greatly to the deterioration, and not just deterioration, but downfall of traditional Judaism. Boys and girls alike should be introduced into the inner halls of not only the written tradition, but also the oral tradition. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, how could I say it? Separate was not equal. Separate was not equal. Willy-nilly, if it's separate, then the boys are going to get the attention, the boys are going to get the more robust Judaic curriculum. Unacceptable, co-education, study Talmud in the same classroom, on principle. And if you don't, it's a big problem. It is regrettable oversight. And he claims that separation has led to the deterioration greatly contributed and downfall of traditional Judaism. And the school that he founded, in the Maimonides School in Boston, it was a co-ed school, huge discussion up until today. Members of his family, students, scholars. Did he really want it that way? Was it only that way because they couldn't found a school that would have separate classes? It just wouldn't work. There wasn't enough financial support. The zeitgeist wasn't available that would allow for this. Huge discussion. It's an ongoing discussion. The reality is that it still continues to be a coeducational school. And the reality is that this is what he wrote in 1953. Second issue, mixed pews in the synagogue. Second issue. According to traditional Jewish law, men and women do not sit together during prayer. There is a physical separation between the sexes in an Orthodox synagogue, either sitting on the same floor with some kind of a physical separation, or the women are in a balcony. Men and women do not sit together next to one another, according to traditional Jewish law. One of the hallmarks of both Reform Judaism, founded at the beginning of the 19th century, and Conservative Judaism, founded in the middle of the 19th century, was to do away with the separation between men and women in prayer and allow men and women to sit together. In America in the 1950s, Conservative Judaism was on the rise, extremely powerful, and there was a strong move to turn formerly Orthodox synagogues, whose membership had begun to dwindle, into conservative synagogues. And of course, the first thing to go was the physical separation between men and women in the synagogue. I would even go so far as to say that there was a stampede in America in the 50s to turn Orthodox, formerly Orthodox synagogues into conservative synagogues. Even many traditional Orthodox Jews at that time began to feel that maybe this is what we have to do, that maybe it's not so bad. Maybe it's necessary in order to maintain the cohesive nature, to maintain the viability of the synagogue, and it would not be wise for them to express their opposition to this pretty much accepted trend in American Jewish life in mid-20th century. Rabbi Soloveitchik was understandably very alarmed by this development. Orthodoxy was actually in danger of disappearing. That might be a little bit of an overstatement, but not a lot of an overstatement. And he did all he could to stop what he considered to be this very alarming trend. And he took a very strong stand on the issue of separation of men and women in prayer in order to do so. Source number two. He wrote a series of articles, 1954, in Yiddish, in one of the Yiddish newspapers that appeared, that was published in New York. And we have a piece of one of these articles. This is the question which has been raised, and he is extremely strong here in his position. Lately, there's been a great increase, understatement, great increase in the number of synagogues where men and women sit together. Many of them are attended by Jews who designate themselves as Orthodox. Shall Orthodox Judaism then consider such synagogues as an inevitable development and become reconciled to them? Or must it assume a militant stand against them? To make my position on this laden question absolutely clear, I would like to relate this incident. And this incident will, in fact, make his position absolutely clear. A young man moved into a suburb of Boston. He lives in Boston, suburb of Boston, where the only existent synagogue had men and women sitting together. He asked me, I also live in Boston, I was a closest rabbi, I'm a prominent rabbi, he reached out to me, didn't have to go far, I was in the neighborhood. He asked me what he should do on the high holidays. Until then, on account of the mixed seating, he had not entered the synagogue. But on the days of awe, he was very reluctant to remain at home. I mean, if you don't go to the synagogue on a Sabbath, you don't go to the synagogue on a Sabbath, but not to go on the days of awe was inconceivable for this person. So what am I supposed to do? I answered him that it was better for him to pray at home on both of the holidays, Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and not cross the threshold of that synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in the synagogue. Part of the ritual on Rosh Hashanah, on the beginning of the new year, is to sound a ram's horn. Somebody blows a ram's horn, and that's part of the ritual, and that's actually a biblically mandated part of the ritual for that day. So he bumped into the guy who was going to do that, who was going to blow the ram's horn in the synagogue. And this man warned him that if he didn't come to the synagogue, he simply would not hear the ram's horn at all. For the man would not sound the shofar again privately for his benefit. I mean, one option is he could blow it in the synagogue, and then afterwards he can go to this guy's house. They could meet on a street corner. They could find a place, and he would blow it for him again. But that wasn't going to happen. Which means that he's not going to be able to fulfill the obligation of, biblical obligation of hearing the ram's horn. The young man practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for a half hour, that he might hear the shofar blasts. I'm not even going to pray there. I'm going to walk in just when they're ready to blow, and I'm going to stand in the back, and I'm going to hear it, and then I'm going to leave. I hesitated not for a moment, but directed him to remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned. Very powerful language. So to give you a sense of how I think, I'm going to tell you this story. So now you get a sense of how I think. Why do I think this way? Why do I take such a strong stand? My stringent position regarding the mingling of men and women arises from several reasons. The first one is the one that you would expect. Namely, Jewish law says that men and women have to be separate. End of conversation. Such mingling is forbidden according to the halacha back all the way to unit number 2, and as we have encountered that word and that concept many times since. In certain instances, biblical law prohibits praying in a synagogue where men and women are seated together. He says something in the next sentence that is extremely extreme. Such a locale has none of the sanctity of a synagogue. And the next sentence is even more extreme. Any prayers offered there are worthless in the eyes of Jewish law. I believe that part of the reason that Rabbi Soloveitchik is really so strong is because he has to fight the fight. Because if he's not strong, really strong, super strong, then many people will slowly begin to think that maybe it's okay. And then before you know it, virtually almost all, many, most Orthodox synagogues in America will disappear. But let's take him for his word. Jewish law says it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. Reason number one. Reason number two, secondly, the separation of the sexes in the synagogue derives historically from the sanctuary, where there were both a court of women and a court of Israelites. The structure of the sanctuary of the temple had a separate section for men and for women. In its martyr's history of 1,000 years, the people of Israel have never violated the sacred principle. So there is history. This practice is sanctified by historical precedent. Moreover, when primitive Christianity arose as a sect in the Holy Land and began to slowly introduce reforms, one of the things that the Christians did was to have men and women sit together. And so therefore what he does is he calls men and women sitting together a Christianization of the synagogue. And that's not a good thing. We don't want a Christianization of the synagogue. It's not just that there's a historical precedent for this, but it reminds us of an attempt to destroy the structure of the synagogue as it had always existed, certainly up until that time. And then thirdly, and this brings us back to one of the previous units, and I saved this particular text for now, the entire concept of family pews. Family pews is men and women sitting together, the mommy and the daddy, and the son and the daughter, family that prays together, stays together. It's a beautiful thing. You want to go to the house of worship and you want to embrace one another in the middle of prayer, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. The entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. There is a conceptual objection, not just a legal objection, not just a historical objection, but a conceptual objection. Prayer means communion with the master of the world, and therefore, prayer means withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man, a person, must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. At the end of the day, you surround yourself with whoever you want to surround yourself. But at the end of the day, ultimately, they can't help you. Only God can help you. And the way to recognize that is to situate yourself in a place where you are by yourself. You're not surrounded. You're deliberately not surrounded by your loved ones. Clearly, the presence of women among men or of men among women, which often evokes a certain frivolity in the group, either in spirit or in behavior, can contribute little to the sanctification or to the deepening of religious feeling, nor can it help instill the mood in which a man, a person, must be immersed when he, she would communicate with the Almighty. On legal grounds, on historical grounds, on conceptual definition of prayer grounds, this is not going to happen. Orthodoxy has to fight. Orthodoxy must mobilize its forces. And we can do it. I do not believe that this battle will be lost. There were many who believed that it was already lost. The battle was already lost. He hung tough. We're going to fight this, and we're going to change it, and we're going to retain an identity for the traditionalist Orthodox community in the United States. Slowly over the course of time, the tide has indeed shifted. Orthodoxy has become stronger, due, I would say, in no small measure to the students who Rabbi Soloveitchik produced, who went out into the American Jewish community and represented Orthodoxy in a more compelling way. I want now to share some concluding thoughts. First, we have repeatedly seen in the course of our journey how Rabbi Soloveitchik was unusually self-revelatory. He shared a lot about himself. He shared a lot about his private thoughts. He shared a lot about his private experiences. You remember how frightened he was when he was a little boy? You remember how he was, quote, on the verge of losing my sanity in the spring of 1967 when he suffered a triple loss, particularly on the deathbed of his wife when she passed away. You remember how helpless he felt when he was at her deathbed. A student of his once wrote that he heard Rabbi Soloveitchik remark that in the olden days, teachers really didn't need to speak a lot about themselves and refrained from sharing personal, intimate details about themselves. But today, he said, the student overheard Rabbi Soloveitchik say, but today it's different because today contemporary students don't have enough direct access to role models who they could see behaving in a certain way that would be an inspiration for them. Rabbi Soloveitchik saw people. He was in the company of people. So he didn't have to talk about it. They didn't talk about it to him. You remember when he saw his grandfather pray, his grandfather didn't describe it to him, he just did it. But today we don't have those experiences, and therefore it's important, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, for the teacher to be more open, to be more self-revelatory, to be, I would use the word, this is my word, more human, in order to be able to be a role model for students. For him, self-revelation was an educational necessity. More examples, source number 3, chapter 1, Lonely Man of Faith. Keep coming back to this as a central work of Rabbi Soloveitchik's. He has a little bit of an introduction, important, and now chapter 1. Source number 3, the nature of the dilemma can be stated in a 3-word sentence. I am lonely. Let me emphasize, however, that by stating I am lonely, I do not intend to convey to you the impression that I'm alone. I thank God, do enjoy the love and friendship of many. I meet people, I talk, I preach, I argue, I reason, I'm surrounded by comrades and acquaintances. And yet, companionship and friendship do not alleviate the passional experience of loneliness. Passional means having to do with feelings. The feeling experience of loneliness, which trails me constantly. I am lonely because at times I feel rejected and thrust away by everybody. Everybody. That's a big word, everybody. Not excluding my most intimate friends. And in the words of the psalmist, quote, my father and my mother have forsaken me, and there was nobody, with the exception of his wife, who was more important to him, and who had a greater influence on him than my mother and my father. And he quotes the verse in Psalms, my father and my mother have forsaken me, ring quite often in my ears like the plaintive cooing of the turtle dove. I get a sense, and this is JJ talking, that this is not literary hyperbole, but I get a sense that there's something to it. Maybe not as stark as he describes it, but he is uncovering a little piece of the inside. Source number 4, another example. In the second full paragraph, the confusion about one's true needs is typical of man as man, without distinction of life experiences. That the human condition is such that the human condition presupposes that whatever stage of life a person finds oneself, they're not really sure. They're confused about what their role is and what they should be doing. Does a young man understand his basic needs? If he did, this would be different. Is the middle-aged man oriented? That would be different. Does the old man know what should and what should not matter to him? Let me speak for myself. This is typical Rabbi Soloveitchik. And as we wrap up, I want to come back to certain aspects of his thinking and personality that I would like to come back and highlight on the way out of this journey that we're taking together. Let me speak for myself. I know that I'm perplexed, that my fears are irrational and incoherent. At times I'm given over to panic. I am afraid of death. At other times I'm horrified by the thought of becoming, God forbid, incapacitated during my lifetime. One of my greatest fears is related to the observance of the Day of Atonement. I am fearful that I might be compelled because of weakness or sickness to desecrate this holiest day of all days. I may not be aware what's going on. I may grab a bottle of water, I may eat, I may drink, I may desecrate. I am panic-stricken. I don't know what to fear, what not to fear. I am utterly confused and ignorant. Related to this self-revelation was Rabbi Soloveitchik's capacity, and I would say remarkable capacity, to admit failure publicly. To admit failure publicly, which I think it would be fair to say is not an easy thing for many people to do, not even to admit failure privately, let alone in front of 3,000 people. Source number 5. We already saw parts of this source, paragraph, a Jew is not just supposed to know about what Judaism is, but is supposed to experience what Judaism is. Another leitmotif in his thought, thinking, writings, and teachings. The difference between knowing and experiencing. Paragraph beginning, let me make an admission here. I will confide in you. There are 3,500 people sitting there, and I'm going to confide in you, like he's having a conversation with somebody at the table. This is the toughest of all jobs, this being the ability to transmit not the knowledge of Judaism, but the feeling of Judaism. The most difficult of all tasks. I know from my own experience how difficult it is. I am not modest. I am far from being modest. I know that I'm a good teacher. I can teach halacha. I can teach Jewish law. I can explain the most abstract concepts. I'm good at it. I know I'm good at it. I can popularize the most complex Talmudic debate and break it down into its component parts. I can explain and elucidate abstract ideas, and I can do it really well. And then he goes ahead and he gives a whole bunch of examples. But, next paragraph, one trick I have not mastered, one thing that I cannot do to perfection, is to tell everything else I could do to perfection, but one thing that I can't do to perfection is to tell my students how I felt on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur when I was their age, the emotions I experienced. Not what I knew about it. I knew a lot, and I could tell them what I knew, but I am not good at and have not succeeded at sharing with them, telling them, divulging to them how I felt. The bottom of the page, it is very difficult. I have not entirely succeeded in passing on this part of Judaism. Source number 6, very, very similar. As a teacher, I can transmit my ideas to my pupils on an intellectual level. When it comes to the transmission and passing of experiences, I feel so inadequate. Sometimes it drives me to despair. And the last source, to me, is the most, the richest source for this, is in source number 7. And he first makes the point that his students have mastered knowledge, but his students have not mastered the experience. They're great at knowledge, they know a ton, but they are not sophisticated when it comes to the inner, personal, private. To use the language of Rabbi Soloveitchik, not just the formal compliance with the law, that they know how to do, but the law as a living experience. And therefore I affirm, final paragraph, that I can identify one of those responsible for the present situation, and that is none other than myself. I have not fulfilled my obligation as a guide in Israel. I seem to have lacked the ability, the personal power required of a teacher or a rabbi, or perhaps I lacked some of the desire to fulfill the role completely, and I did not devote myself completely to this task. When it comes to mental greatness, I'm good to go. My students got it, know it. I'm an excellent teacher. I could convey anything to them. But I have not seen much growth on the experiential plane. I have not succeeded in living in common with them, in cleaving to them, in bestowing some of my personal warmth on them. My words, it would seem, have not kindled the divine spark in sensitive hearts. I have fallen short in my role as one who spreads the Torah of the heart. And he concludes, and the failing lies with me. His younger son-in-law, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, wrote about him, and I quote, Rabbi Soloveitchik has imbued us with a sense of both the frailty of majesty and the majesty of frailty. Just an extraordinary formulation. Rabbi Soloveitchik has imbued my father-in-law. Rabbi Soloveitchik has imbued us with a sense of both the frailty of majesty and the majesty of frailty. Second concluding thought, source number 8. As we conclude our analysis of the life and thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik, I bring your attention to an article that he published. It was one of the 5 articles that he published together in 1978. We looked at the one in memory of the mother of his son-in-law. We looked at the one entitled The Community, actually at great length. Here's one entitled Majesty and Humility. And here, notice how this section begins, the basic dialectic of man. We're back to dialectic, very important for him. It's not all worked out, doesn't all neatly fit together, it's not always resolved, but tension coexists simultaneously, and that's called dialectic, and that's just the way the human condition is. We, each one of us, lives with contradiction. We live in tension with parts of ourselves. And he points here to 2 foci of a human being. The verse at the beginning of Genesis says that God created man dust of the earth. I'm going to read the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is ha-adama. Translate, the earth. And in his commentary on this text, one of the most famous medieval Jewish commentators, known by the acronym of Rashi, brings 2 different interpretations. Number 1, God gathered the dust from which man was fashioned. The verse says, and he created man from the earth. What earth? Where earth? Which part of the earth did God go to create man? First interpretation, he went to the whole earth. He went to the entire earth to create man. So God went to Paraguay, and then he went to Indonesia, and then he stopped off in the Czech Republic, and then he went to the beautiful mountains of Nepal, and of course he came to New York City, and he scooped up a little piece of dust from the whole earth and together created Adam. Second interpretation, he took the dust from which man was made from that spot which was designated by the Almighty at the very dawn of creation as the future site of the altar. Later on, there's a verse that says, that refers to the altar that was in the temple as, I'll say it in Hebrew because you'll understand the analogy, Mizbach Adama, an altar made of earth. Light bulb. It says earth there, and it says earth here. Which earth is here? It's the earth here that's associated with the earth there. Where was the altar? The altar was on the temple in Jerusalem. God went to Jerusalem, scooped up a little dust from the Temple Mount, and from that dust created Adam. 2 interpretations. Rabbi Soloveitchik develops both of them. Man was created, first interpretation, of cosmic dust. God gathered the dust of which man was fashioned from all parts of the earth, indeed from all the uncharted lanes of creation. Man belongs everywhere. He is no stranger to any part of the universe. In short, man is a cosmic being. First, man is cosmic through his intellectual involvement. His intellectual curiosity is cosmic, it's universal in its dimension. He wants to know not only about things that are close to him, like the flowering bush in his backyard, but he wants to know about things that are far away from him, millions of light years away. Man, human beings are all over the place. They're all over the earth. Everything is of interest to them. They occupy a space that's not bounded. Nothing limits them. That's the first interpretation. Let us examine middle column, the other interpretation. Man was created from the dust of a single spot. Man is committed to one focus, to one locus. The Creator assigned him a single spot he calls home. Man is not cosmic. He is here-minded. He is rooted. He's a rooted being, not cosmopolitan, but provincial, a villager who belongs to the soil that fed him as a child and to the little world into which he was born. Middle of the next column, the dust of which man was fashioned was not, according to the second interpretation, taken from all parts of the universe according to this approach, but from a single spot on a mountain where an altar was many, many years later constructed. As we said before, each man is created from and attached to a single spot, the origin from which he cannot escape. The home for which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back no matter how far he has traveled. Quote, home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter home from the hill, end quote. These beautiful lines by Robert Louis Stevenson contain more than a nostalgic note. But I would like to suggest in this second concluding thought is that even though Rabbi Soloveitchik does not apply this to himself, I apply this to him. With all of his general knowledge, and we have encountered it, and I'm just going to remind you, just in Halachic Man, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Rudolf Otto, Karl Barth, Edward Spranger, Ferdinand Lassalle, Rousseau, Nietzsche, Bergson, Spengler, Heidegger, Plato, Aristotle, Galileo, Newton, Husserl, Scheller, Berkeley, Hermann Cohen, Don Scotus, only in the beginning and end of Halachic Man, and with all of his Jewish-Christian dialogue, and with all of Adam 1, who's flying airplanes and building hospitals and curing the sick, and is involved with technological advancements, with all of this, the home for Rabbi Soloveitchik was, in Hebrew, Beit Midrash, in English, the study hall. What we saw as the four cubits of halacha, he roamed wide and far, and he did roam wide and far. But then, for him, he came home, and I'm suggesting as we leave him, that home, existential home for him, was in the study hall in front of a Talmudic tractate. Third concluding thought. In 2011, his younger daughter, Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, wrote an article entitled Reflections on the Influence of the Rav, the Rabbi. She actually spelled it R-O-V, which is how he's known in a more traditional circle, the Rabbi, namely my father. Reflections on the Influence of the Rav on the American Jewish Religious Community, 2011. So he's gone now for a number of years. So where are we on the influence of Rabbi Soloveitchik on the American Jewish religious community in 2011? She has a section in this article. It's a magnificent article. It's entitled Long-Term Influence. What is the long-term influence of my father almost two decades after his passing and two and a half decades after his voice was last heard in public? I believe there is increasing interest in Israel and a decline of his influence in the United States. In Israel, she says, there are people who are looking for voices. Israel is in a complex place. People are searching for meaning. And many people hitherto had reflected upon and been very greatly influenced by someone else who in Israel is called the Rav, and that is Rabbi Abraham Cook, who served as the earliest chief rabbi in the land of Israel, a major, powerful intellect for the religious Zionist community. But there are many people who are looking, in addition to that Rav, to this Rav, and they're trying to create modes of approaching the reality in which they find themselves. And they're being drawn more to Rabbi Soloveitchik's, to my father's, teachings. A number of his books have been translated into Hebrew, she points out, and one of them sold, and more than one, sold more copies in Israel in Hebrew translation than in the United States. So in Israel, she is assessing the situation, and Rabbi Soloveitchik's influence is on the way up. In the United States, I believe that the influence of my father is on the decline. And part of the community which he taught and directed is moving in other directions. There are those who are moving to the right, and they're rejecting the Torah and approach as being a legitimate one. And she is very upset about it. They are turning away from participation in the general culture as part of our tradition. And they are finding their home exclusively in the four cubits of Torah, shying away from general culture and a commitment to Zionism. And they're so convinced that they're right that they're even prepared to say that Rabbi Soloveitchik himself really didn't mean what he wrote when he said that Adam 1 is important and that Torah and is important and that Zionism is important. That he really didn't mean it either. In other words, they are co-opting his thinking, his legacy, to their particular position. And then there are those, writes Dr. Lichtenstein, who are turning to the left, and she believes are misusing the more liberal aspects of Rabbi Soloveitchik's teachings as support for positions that they take that she writes he never would have taken. There are many people, and now I'm quoting of the right and the left, who claim to speak in the name of my father. Yet generally these voices do not faithfully represent him. Each one presents a different facet of my father, and few represent his full complexity and depth. It is indeed painful for his family and his devoted and faithful disciples to witness this dismemberment. It's a powerful word. My father is being dismembered. This one takes this piece, and this one takes this piece, the piece that they like, and it's not true. And so I, in particular, right now, am grateful for this opportunity to try to express and to expose the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik to a larger learned audience, particularly in the United States. And now for my final comment. For my final comment, I want to borrow the title of an essay that was written by Soren Kierkegaard. Soren Kierkegaard, very famous Danish philosopher, wrote a lot. And he wrote not such a well-known essay entitled Concluding Unscientific Postscript to the Philosophical Fragments. So my formal eight-part presentation on the life and thought, the philosophical fragments of Rabbi Joseph P. Soloveitchik, will conclude momentarily. So I want to conclude with a concluding unscientific postscript. Rabbi Soloveitchik was well known and highly respected for his original mind and charismatic personality, his intimate knowledge of and appreciation for the totality of Jewish tradition, while also at the same time enjoying mastery over the philosophical contributions of Western culture. His intense fealty to Jewish tradition, combined with a real openness to the best of the world around him, his unbounded imagination and relentless precision, his wide-ranging sweep and rigorous discipline, his spellbinding oratorical skills and charming sense of humor. We didn't really get into the charming sense of humor. Charming sense of humor. His enthralling eloquence and prodigious pedagogic skills, his radical, uncompromising intellectual honesty and demanding search for truth, his economy of expression and clarity of exposition, his dazzling intellect and total lack of pretense. He was an extraordinary teacher. He was a master pedagogue. But Rabbi Soloveitchik is no longer with us. His physical presence has passed on, and the world that he was is gone. But new worlds remain to be created, new generations, and that's you. New generations, including our own, beginning with our own, needs to be nurtured, need to be educated. And to be successful at this task, to face the challenges of our time, to inspire those in our generation and those in generations as yet unborn to thrive in the joy of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a Jew, we can benefit greatly from understanding Rabbi Soloveitchik's teachings and appreciating their relevance to us. What needs to endure for the future are the substance of his ideas, the compelling nature of his teachings, and the content of his Torah. When I was a little boy, Rabbi Soloveitchik stroked my cheek. 6 decades later, I still feel the force of his touch and the warmth of his caress. Rabbi Joseph, son of Rabbi Moshe and Pesia, may his soul be bound up in the bonds of eternal life. Thank you.
What do you think viewers of this course who do not naturally find themselves presently in the community that Rabbi Soloveitchik was the leader of inside of modern Orthodoxy, who are Jews that don't worship in that way or who are not Jewish at all, what should those viewers take away from this course?
I think what is universally useful and relevant about Rabbi Soloveitchik's life and teachings is a profound, nuanced, thoughtful analysis of what does it mean to live in different worlds. We all find ourselves living in different worlds. We live in different worlds, whether it's our personal lives, family lives, and our professional lives. We live in different worlds, whether we're part of a religious community, however we want to define what that is, whatever the extent of that engagement may be, and whatever it looks like, and also our private lives. We live lives as members of communities. We live lives as individuals. How does one negotiate? How does one think about simultaneously existing in multiple spaces and doing so with integrity and with meaning at the same time? In Rabbi Soloveitchik's case, it expressed itself in deep, intense commitment to Jewish living and Jewish learning, and also a very deep and sustained appreciation of the culture of the world around him. Two values, two worlds that don't necessarily fit in absolute consonance with one another. But he lived them both at the same time with great integrity and provided a role model for us about what does it mean to live in multiple spaces without compromising on any one of them and to live so with depth and with meaning and with substance and with authenticity. And I think we can benefit from this analysis, this multi-lecture unit analysis, to try to think about our own lives and how do we negotiate this complexity, and to recognize that we too can see tremendous value in a religious tradition, whatever that tradition may be, and at the same time feel that we're not compromising on our individuality, on our commitment to the culture in which we live, that we can simultaneously pay fealty and respect to a culture and at the same time revere and have a deep connection to a religious tradition.